Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Friday's Inside Story. Really good to see you here. Just to let a couple more people in. I'm here today with Jo Treasure, who is the author of these wonderful novels. This one, The Book of Air, The Male Gaze, and Besotted. And we're going to talk about these and his other work over the next kind of 45 minutes or so. So, Jo, thank you so much for coming along to join us today. Welcome to the Goldster family. And tell us about your writing and how you got into it. What was your career before you began writing, or did you instantly go into knowing you wanted to be a novelist?
No, I've been addicted to fiction since I was a small child have always read. I studied English at university eventually, and then I taught English, and I was a drama teacher. I kind of, as an English teacher, I got into directing plays. And I think, probably looking back on it, for a long time, that was satisfied my creative drive to be putting on plays, and increasingly probably collaborating with the author, particularly Shakespeare needed help, I found. I was really in midlife, I just suddenly started writing and found it was a sort of an essential form of expression for me.
And did you always intend to write novels, or did you not intend to write plays, or do you write plays as well?
Well, when I was teaching, I wrote some plays for particular purposes, for students. There was a French teacher, very dynamic, who took students to a student festival in France and asked me one day to write a play. And he said, Joe, I wonder, if you wrote a play in English and the language assistant will translate it into French, would you be willing to do that for a specific cast? And I said, sure, yeah. And he said, what's it called? And I said, well, you only told me this 30 seconds ago. And he said, but I've got to put the application in the post this afternoon. So I've no idea what it's called. He said, I've always thought Cette Époque-là would be a good name for a play. And I said, yeah, fine, let's call it that. So that, in a way, that kind of launched me. You know, it was like a half hour, 40 minute play for, you know, who was a team of people, like a chorus, because they weren't very confident, and three or four people who really wanted to take a lead. So I had a kind of a structure. But oddly, writing, even though I'd been involved in directing plays, writing drama, I'd never felt it was a natural medium for me.
Yeah.
It was once I wrote the first paragraph of what became my first unpublished novel, I sort of felt at home in it. So
your first unpublished novel. Do you have lots of unpublished novels then?
No, I have one unpublished novel.
And do you think you will publish that one, or do you think you just never want to?
No, I don't think so. I think it's got lots of qualities, and I submitted it to quite a lot of agents eventually, and got a couple of what I considered encouraging rejections. No, they're not just a formal note. But
sorry, I thought my phone is turned off, and I forgot to turn the off on my answer phone. Sorry.
And so, something saying we really like the writing, and there's a lot of good qualities here, but it's not really for us, you know. So I took that to be a sign of encouragement, and decided at some point that I wanted to get better at it. And so I did a course. I did an MA course.
What course did you do?
it was at the Royal Holloway in London, and it was the I joined the by chance the first year of a new course in 2004 at the Royal Holloway, taught by Andrew Motion, who
amazing,
and he'd previously been at in Norwich and University of East Anglia, and started this new course in London.
Gosh, how fantastic!
So, yeah, it was a very fortunate experience for me in lots of ways.
Brilliant. And so your first novel, the first one you've had published anyway, I should say, The Male Gaze. I'm going to show this to people. Now, this is inspired by Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Tell us about this. Were you living there? How did you come to write it? What was the inspiration behind this? It's very interesting. Explain to people what the story is.
Yeah, so I was in LA, in Los Angeles, because my wife was from there, and I went and joined her there. For 4 years, from 2000 to 2004, which was the first George W. Bush term in office. And of course, it was a tumultuous 4 years because 9/11, the launching of the so-called war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And so all that I observed, and being a British person in America, was a really particular experience during those things, because there was a lot of nationalism and flag waving and so on that I felt I couldn't quite identify with because I was a foreigner. So it was interesting. And I started the course in 2004 in London. And the first thing, what I was working on, it wasn't my unpublished novel. I'd started working on something new set in Britain. It got very heavily criticized by the other students, and I was a bit downhearted. And Andrew Motion said, "Well, you've lived in other countries. Why don't you try writing something in another country?" It was that was his threw that out as a kind of. And so I took that as an instruction, and I started writing this book. And yeah, so it's not at all autobiographical, except that I crammed into it all the sorts of most interesting kinds of encounters and experiences I felt I'd had in 4 years of LA. So I created a first person narrator who is sort of like me, but more discombobulated, more alienated than me, less articulate, probably. You know, less clear about politics and so on. So yes. It's a sort of a more naive, I don't know, a more naive version of me in some way.
And, just put a link to it in the chat for everyone, by the way. You can see it there. Yeah, sorry.
And so I had had him describe his experience from sort of day to day in LA. And there he has close encounters with brushes with political violence and so on, and it was a way of taking a sort of sideways, somewhat satirical look at this very real issue, an issue I felt very deeply about how to respond, how we respond to terrorism, and what it means for us. So
I really liked the way I felt when I was reading that. I kept hearing that Sting song, Englishman in New York, in my head, because I like the way you do feel he's just slightly not quite taking it. What is this strange place I'm living in? And we've probably all felt like this when we've been in other countries. You speak the language, you think, oh, I know it. And then something completely throws you and you think, really? Is that normal behavior here? And I know I teach American students in England and they constantly have that, you know, in reverse here, thinking, wow, this society is not quite what I thought it was going to be. And I think you do that really well. I was interested that you made the point of saying it wasn't autobiographical. Do you find that people assume that you're not? I think most novelists feel they have to say that everybody assumes you must be writing about your own life.
Yeah, I suppose people are perhaps inclined to make that assumption. But I felt I wanted to say that mainly because the key thing is an Englishman in Los Angeles out of his depth. That much was absolutely I could relate to.
Yes. And of course, there's always going to be something in there. If you've lived in a place, you are going to have some of that in there. And yeah. So do you want to explain a little bit about the plot of this novel without giving away any spoilers so people know what to expect?
Well, I suppose there's the personal level. He is somewhat in conflict with his wife. He's trying to write a textbook on religious studies. So he's right what would be a secondary school textbook of some kind. You've challenged me now to remember what this was all about. But, so he's struggling to write.
Yes.
He's struggling to know, therefore, what he's doing there. He's followed his wife to America, who is a British woman who is an academic. I think she's an art historian.
Yes, she is an art historian. Yes, she is.
That's right. And that's why he's there. So he's only there as a trailing spouse, I suppose. That's his predicament.
And instead of struggling to write, I think a lot of Goldstone members would appreciate that when he keeps saying, I must be able to write this, and then he's just done nothing but, a whole page full of B's or whatever, the letter B or whatever. And he just, think, I must be able to do this. And I think we can all identify with that. I know a lot of Goldstone members are doing the Goldstone writing course or thinking about writing something themselves, either fiction or nonfiction. So I think that people would really enjoy the fact that, yes, we all get that. And that made me smile in a kind of wry way when I was reading it, that, yes, you can tell when a writer's writing about writing. It's just, you think, oh, we've all been there. So your second novel, now I haven't had a chance to read this, I'm sorry, but am I right, this is based partly on your childhood, or has it just taken inspiration from that?
Yeah, the heart of that story is twin brothers who, and it moves back and forth between the two of them in their 30s and them as teenagers. So that's the center of it. And there is a teenage girl who is sort of ambiguously related to them. And that's the sort of opening predicament.
Are you a twin?
No, but I have a younger brother who is 16 months younger than me.
Ah.
And there were nine of us in the family.
Wow.
And I was the sixth and Wilfred was the seventh. And the two of us, I mean, I've realised in adult life that we were unusually entangled in growing up and unusually bonded. Very different characters in lots of externally measurable ways. Mm-hmm. But very, very close, and I was sort of celebrating that relationship and those differences in the novel and exploring them in a way that was somewhat it moves between comedy and tragedy in some way, as my writing tends to. The connection with the family was for the teenage episodes, though they are made up at the level of the narrative, there are six absolutely recognisable characters who anybody who knew my family would be able to map on my parents and the four youngest members of the family. So that much I explored fictionalising the kind of the home scene in its kind of chaotic comedy. As I knew it as a child, so that in that sense, yes, it's absolutely rooted in my feeling. I mean, in some ways, it was a kind of a love song to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
I realized it was and both these characters are struggling in the novel, but I think in a way which I'm very, this younger brother figure is very admirable.
And what do your family think of it? Did they recognize the portraits? Did they like that? Or did you not let them read it until it was published? How did that process go?
You know, well, my parents were already dead by then.
Right.
Wilfred, I sent to him before it was published in manuscript, my younger brother. And he wrote back and he said it wasn't easy to read. And he said he had to read it twice. First, just to deal with the fact that there was recognizable material, and then to try and get a sense of it as a novel. But he was very generous about it.
Yeah, good.
And on the whole, other than that, my brothers and sisters are very supportive of my
own. And was the process very different? Because you'd already had a novel published by the time you started working on this one. Is that right? The Male Gaze was already out there when you started.
Yes.
So was it a very different process working on one with the standpoint of being a published novelist? Presumably you had an agent and a publisher waiting for this one. I know that doesn't always happen, but was that a totally different thing? Did you feel you had more confidence, or was it a question of, oh my goodness, can I do it again?
Yeah, I think the latter more than the before. So I've written the first one within about a year from start to finish. First pushed into it in the middle of the course, I produced a chapter. Yeah. And by the way, the title, The Male Gaze, I gave to that first chapter, and I sort of lived to regret it. I thought it, you know, the book was universally reviewed by female reviewers. I mean, it got very positive reviews, but I felt it had to get past a certain sort of prejudice about who is this bloke daring to use this title, and what does he mean by it, and what does it mean? And I was sort of sorry about it afterwards. But anyway, that having had a really very easy time writing that novel, it took me, I think, 13 months from start to finish. I had an agent. I had a two-book deal with Picador. And I had two years to produce the next manuscript. And I did feel under pressure. It was a very different experience. I was sorry that I didn't just spend 4 years and say, you can wait for it.
That's interesting advice.
I felt very dutiful and somewhat in awe of the professionals in the field. And that I had this contract. In the end, I submitted it. My editor was brilliant, I think. The Male Gaze had hardly a thing was altered from the manuscript I turned in to what was published. With Besotted, one third of it in length was cut completely by the time it was published. And another third, that's to say a half of what was left, was significantly rewritten by the time my editor had finished sending me.
Editor should do, though. I think that's brilliant. I hear so frequently from authors that they don't get any editorial guidance now, and that they wish they had done. So I think that's really great to hear. So it's true, the thing we always hear, and I know when I worked in publishing, people would say that difficult second novel, and it really is the case. Why do you think that is? What is the process that becomes so numbing and makes people so worried about doing that?
Well, because I think just that novels are not necessarily things you can turn out and you can write to order. I think there is a great benefit to me of having having a deadline, of having somebody waiting for something. That's the on the positive side.
Yeah.
And I always think of, it was probably something Cole Porter said when he was asked which comes first, the words or the music. And he said, first comes the phone call. And I sort of respond to that, because I think, I mean, if somebody wants something from you, that is the biggest and the encouragement to do it, other than just working in a vacuum.
You had that experience, didn't you, when you had to come up with a title in 2 minutes for your play?
Right, exactly.
So maybe that's what you need. You need that deadline every time. I have a novel by tomorrow afternoon. You'd have no problem writing it. It gave you too long. That was what it was. But no, I like the fact that you made the point. You wished you'd been able to just have the confidence to say, I need 4 years. I think I've said this on Goldster before, and I remember when I interviewed Joanne Harris, she talked about it, that one of my favourite tweets, I will always remember it, is when she published a new book, and Waterstones tweeted and said, you know, after a break of 7 years, Joanne Harris is back. And she quoted it and said, it wasn't a break, I was writing it. You know, I just thought, people think that you can just turn that. Some people can. And if you're writing to a particular formula, we've had romance authors on who talk very openly, they write to a formula and they do a summer book and a winter book, and they spend the summer writing their winter book and the winter writing their summer book. And that works for some people, but not everybody and not every genre. Yeah. And I think it's really important to actually be able to embrace that and say, actually, I can't just do it in 2 years because this novel needs longer to you know, create itself.
And one of the things I've discovered about myself as a writer is that I have a great difficulty doing anything that would be remotely like repeating myself. And, yes. I say that just as an observation about myself. I don't think there's any great strength in that. But there is I just feel my agent wanted me to write about America again, to write about LA right. again.
Yes.
And I felt I've said everything I've got to say.
Yeah. About
it. Anything else I wrote about Los Angeles after that book would just be the sort of the leftovers.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. I'm glad you stuck to your guns on that because you don't want to be pigeonholed either. And it did strike me how different they all three are. And I think that's really good. So tell us about this one, your newest one, The Book of Air. Tell us what it's all about and why it's become so weirdly relevant to modern life.
weirdly relevant, but not sadly modish. So it was published in 2017. And yeah, I had difficulty. I think it's my best book, and the I couldn't get a publisher. My agent, who was a big name, a powerful agent, lost interest in me because I didn't win any prizes. And fair enough, he had.
Many books are published that don't win prizes? Ridiculous.
Picador didn't want to publish. Besotted. So first of all, I had to find a new agent, and I was very lucky to find a brilliant agent who took me on the strength of this unpublished third novel, the Book of Air, and did her best to find a publisher. And eventually, after a couple of years, I decided that I must self-publish it by a publisher called Clink Street. And I've got very mixed feelings about all that. So, for example, I've said I have this first unpublished novel. I'm not going to put that through this process. Yeah. I just felt with this book, I felt objectively that it was the best of the three in certain ways.
Yeah.
The deepest, certainly, of the three. And I didn't want the last book out in my name as my last published book to be Besotted. I wanted it to be this one. So that's why I decided to do it. I had this idea many years ago. It was in fact 1987. I read The Handmaid's Tale when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this vague idea. This was long before I'd even thought of writing a book or begun attempting to write. But this thought came into my head, just like this: if ever I were to write a book set in the future, a dystopia or something, this would be the kind of book I'd like to write. So something I connected with about it. The Book of Air is not remotely like that in any ways people might expect, but it was a kind of a spark of something in my mind. And I kind of harbored that idea. So it was at least just a sort of an aspirational model of the kind of book that one might set in the future. And I haven't read a great deal of dystopian fiction or futuristic writing. It's not something I'm particularly interested in as a genre. Another model for me was that Will Self had published a book called The Book of Dave. And actually, I found it unreadable. I mean, you know, Will Self is just, he loves chewing, you know, complicated words. And it was full of jokes, but I loved the reviews of it. I loved the idea. I loved the idea of a future society, in this case, modeled on the writings, the random writings of a cab driver, a rather prejudiced cab driver in London who writes it. So I thought I didn't want to do that. Sort of had that idea in my mind as well. And I just thought, I love the idea of a society that has randomly selected a book. And it, for me, it would have to be a classic novel. And that's turned it, not reading it as a novel, but is reading it as a biblical text, a sacred text. So that was the premise of it.
And tell us, because actually, I mean, the reason it's so prescient is it's a deadly virus, isn't it? There's an airborne virus that has, you know, decimated society.
Yes.
And they're having to restructure themselves.
Exactly. So it's the survivors. Tiny communities of survivors, really, in the future. And I was very interested. I didn't want to I'm a very soft-hearted writer. And I didn't want to write a disaster novel in which, you know, we just, things get from bad to worse as mm-hmm. you progress through the book. So I wanted to start when the worst had occurred and then sort of reconstruct some of that and move forward from there. And the virus is a very interesting one because it has a very distinct symptom, which people call the blessing. And it's a sort of a creative impulse. So in a period of time before they succumb to a kind of a disabling fever, the victims produce something artistic with whatever's to hand. They take whatever materials they can find and make art on a wall. As they're staggering under the influence of this, or they make music, they do something. I sort of quite like the idea of this kind of burst of mysterious creativity that comes out of people, as if that's, because I have this feeling that people, we are all creative beings, and we are not all encouraged or allowed to develop or explore.
Oh, yes. I think that's very true. A lot of people have that, you know, that's experience at school where they just, you know, don't get encouraged to do whatever it is that they're going to shine in. So I think that's very true.
And
the book that you choose, the classic book that they use as their biblical text, is of course Jane Eyre.
Yes.
Is this a great favourite of yours?
Yes.
I love Jane Eyre. I haven't actually reread it for years. Maybe we need to do it for Book of the Month. But what was it about Jane Eyre that made you choose it?
I do love it. But also I thought around other possibilities, but very rapidly came back to Jane Eyre. And the reason is because I thought, well, Jane Austen, you know, this world of kind of class, of subtle, nuanced interactions, I had imagined this future survival society. They are, they're a farming community, they are self-sustaining, community. How are they going to make sense of any of that? What would they make sense of of anything in Dickens? The institutions, the overwhelming complexity of those kind of threads of social interactions, the law courts. I mean, all those things. It would be beyond their imagining. So the great thing about Jane Eyre, of course, is it's centered on a big house. That's what they've got, a big house that they've inherited, like a big old manor house and farmland around it. It's very stark, it's very elemental. The experiences are of intense danger, near starvation, huge conflicts. And then, of course, there's the mad woman in the attic. And what they're doing in their society, drawing on this book, is that they're constructing their mythology, their value system, and of course their systems of punishment as well. So all of that they find principally in Jane Eyre.
It's a great idea. And you know, I just thought during the pandemic, did you start thinking, wow, this is a bit weird, are we all going to start to, did you start rereading Jane Eyre and handing it out to people that you knew?
Yeah, it's interesting. See, I thought that a lot of books a lot of books have the premise that they're going to destroy, futuristic books, that they're going to destroy society as we know it. And I did not want anything that would destroy nature, so a nuclear explosion or something. In some ways, it's like the book is like a return to Eden. So nature's fine. It's only the people who decimated. By the way, the publisher at Picador said he found the book too cozy.
Oh, really?
Fair enough. And I felt I've done what I can. I've wiped out, you know.
I was going to say, I don't think I'd have described it as cozy. That's extraordinary.
Well, it has got it's got a lot of optimism in it in some way. That was I think. So I derailed myself with that detail. I can't remember what I was saying. Where was I?
You're saying that nature wasn't destroyed.
I settled on the idea of a virus, and I read a review around the time when I was thinking of this of a book that I didn't read, but I, you know, obviously we read far more reviews than we read books, and this one said the population has been wiped out by some disease. We don't find out anything about that disease very much, except that there was a lot of coughing. That's what the reviewer said. So, and I thought, well, I got to do better than that. Because, I took this as a challenge. I'm going to characterize this disease, give it some color and some shape. So the half of the book is kind of reflecting on what has led up to this cluster of mainly unrelated survivors gathering in a house in the country, and then that interweaves with the other half of the book, which is set in some unspecified time in the future when the same house and the descendants of these survivors have formed a community and have brought together. It turns out they only know of four books, these future dwellers in this house. There are only four books that they can conceive of existing. That is their understanding. And they've got three of them. And one of them is the Book of Air. One of them is the Book of Windows, which is a computer manual. It's like a deeply mystical text that they know tells them something about how people in the end times used to be able to communicate at a distance, but they don't
know what it is.
No sense. And the third of them is the Book of Moon, which is a children's picture book, which also they take to be a book about how the world ends.
Right. Yes.
We say goodnight to everything, including the air and the stars. Everything we say goodnight to eventually. That's how the world will end. So they're interpreting these books as mystical texts.
It sounds like you had real fun writing this, and it felt like a real, I don't know, when you're writing something, sometimes this is just, as you say, the best book you've written, and you just have that feeling that you have to get it out there. And I'm so glad that you did. Tell us about your writing process. So, I mean, I don't know if it's changed a lot since you wrote your first book, but do you plot your novels very meticulously? Do they just grow organically? Has that changed in the writing time, or what, is each one different from the other?
Generally speaking, I write from the beginning, not knowing where it's going. The more I've written, so I've written four novels, at each stage, I have known a bit more as I've gone on. But earlier, I've got a more sense. I had much more sense of the shape of the Book of Air than I had of the earlier books. But even so, it's in some ways, writing a novel for me is somewhat like the experience of reading a novel. So I'm open to what might happen next. And of course, I'm thinking, what could happen? What are these characters likely to do? I have a preference for something interesting happening, or something that will project things forward. But I discovered in writing something that would not have occurred to me before. This much had occurred to me, that any work of art is a negotiation between the conscious and the unconscious mind. So, and that seems a fairly obvious point. The thing that I was a discovery for me was that in writing a novel, I find that the conscious mind needs to be paying attention to the sentence and the paragraph. The unconscious mind is quite good at plot, I've discovered. It's quite good at structure.
Yeah.
The big thing, the big questions, in some way, I feel I don't need to wrestle with. They'll sort themselves out somehow.
Yeah. We've had a comment here. Patrick says, sounds fascinating. Would like to see it someday as a film. Maybe a double bill on TV, Jane Eyre, followed by The Book of Eyre. Fascinating. Doesn't that sound good? And Patrick, until you wrote that, I had never actually made the connection until I read that aloud, of Eyre as in Jane Eyre sounding the same as A-I-R. Obviously, I missed that point the whole time. Aren't I stupid, really, that I didn't really get it?
And it's called the Book of Eyre is a of course it's an airborne virus, but because it's a special text, there are certain words that we don't spell out.
Mm.
And for the young woman narrating the future sections of that book, she doesn't write Eyre, E-Y-R-E.
Y-R-E, A-I-R, yes.
That is a mystical word that you know.
Yeah.
Only.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for that. Have you ever thought about writing it as a film script there, Joe?
I have a treatment of an opening half hour episode.
Oh,
but
fantastic.
I've never done anything with it. It was an interesting thing because it's the first time I've felt, as I said, I didn't feel comfortable particularly writing stage plays, even though I'd had a lot of experience directing in schools. I love TV dramas and films, but I'd never attempted to write a script. This is the first time I've done it. I took the opening of this book and just experimentally, I made a half hour script out of it. What I think is a half hour script, it's hard for me to know because I haven't done anything with it. I don't know who I would send such a thing to.
I think that's really fascinating, and I love the fact that Patrick, as you were talking about it, obviously you had that idea of it being very filmic. Yeah. So is it right that you're writing a memoir at the moment?
Yes,
I am. How is that going, and what prompted that?
Well, I think, you know, increasing age is a thing. Another thing is that my brother Wilfred, who I spoke about before, sadly he died 6 years ago, and that prompted me to start thinking about it because of our lives growing up together. I would be kind of capturing something of his life.
Yeah.
So that was a big trigger for me to get going on it. And it's an interesting project because I don't think of this as a particularly publishable thing at all. I'm driven to do it because I'm driven to write, and I'm creating art in how I shape the sentences and paragraphs, and also because I want to capture things. But while I can remember them, and while there are people who may be interested in them, and I don't imagine that, at least I'm not motivated by the desire to publish it.
Yeah, but I think that's often the case with memoir, and I know quite a few Goldstone members are doing memoirs. I've just finished teaching a course for Cambridge for their online life writing course, and it's fascinating because that's, some people are writing biographies of other people, but most are doing memoirs either of themselves or somebody in their family. And I think that a lot of people, you know, you don't need to publish, you just need to write it. I think the satisfaction is in the writing. I think we perhaps lay far too much emphasis on, oh, are you going to get it published? And students say that all the time. Oh, should I be trying to get it published? Well, if you think that you would enjoy the process and you think other people would be interested, but really, a lot of the time, it's a pretty thankless task, as we know. And a memoir is such an important family document, apart from anything else. I mean, I would urge people to write their memoirs. I wish my father had written his memoirs. I'm very sad that he didn't. We did try to encourage him to. And I just think it doesn't need to be published. It's written for the people. The people who need to read it are not necessarily the book buying public. They are, you know, your family and your friends. So I'm really glad that you're writing that. I think it's something that, you know, it should be a kind of defining part of life. You mentioned, before we get onto your other work, you mentioned about aging. And as you possibly know, Goldster is all about healthy aging. So what are your best tips, do you think, for making the most of life? Is it writing a memoir, or is it just, are there other things that you can share with us here?
Well, having projects and being open to new projects. So for me, writing has always been a lifeline, and I feel very lucky to be doing an activity, to have this drive, which I could think of as a hobby or as a series of projects, though occasionally it's been a professional activity, but it doesn't have to be that. I'm lucky to have such an activity which is very cheap and very portable.
That's very true. I was talking to two writers yesterday. One's a songwriter and one is an author, Mel Hewitt, who actually came on here, if everybody might remember her. She wrote Looking for the Durrells. And I bumped into them yesterday at the Dickens Museum Cafe, which was completely unexpected. And they were talking about the joy of writing on trains, that you can just sit on a train, that you don't have to have anything with you except for a notebook and a pen, and how trains inspire them and how wonderful it is to have such a portable profession. So yeah, there we are. Maybe that's why we all go into it.
That's good. But I think, you know, just any kind of project or learning. I've just signed up. I just discovered that there's a kind of a club in the middle of Balham where I live. It's a sort of a bar with rents out rooms, and there's life drawing there. Well, I did life drawing as an A-level student, and I've signed up to go. Anyone can go. The materials provided. There's a teacher. There's a model. Any standard is allowed. So I've got to go and do that.
Fantastic. So it's keeping interests, I guess. Keeping yourself learning something new.
Yes, yes.
Good. We've got a comment from Emma. She says, I'm halfway through reading the Book of Air and was intrigued by thoughts that women, as represented by the character Agnes, are generally better at coping with tragedies than men, as represented by the character of Jason. Can you comment? Great question, Emma. You always ask great questions.
It's a very good question. And what I love about, one of the things about writing is that kind of question or that kind of concern is something that is absolutely, for me, best left to the unconscious. So I can think about it afterwards, just like a reader can think about it. I think there is some truth in that, instinctively. But I hadn't really thought about it until that question was asked.
Wonderful. Well done, Emma. You managed to provoke an author to think something new about their book. I love that. So now I want to talk about what you were doing during lockdown. So you're a poet as well. Tell us about your poems and tell us about this new project, Out of the Frame, and how it began and how it's developed.
So I haven't really, until a few years ago, thought of myself as a poet. I'm a fiction writer. Back before I started writing fiction, I got a couple of poems published, one in the TLS. But mainly my poems were rejected, and I didn't, and then I gave up writing. And so this, for some reason, the first lockdown, March 2020, it gave me this illusory sense that I was free to write anything I want. And the reason that's an illusion and a joke, of course, is because I'm always free to write anything I want. Nobody cares what I write most of the time. So at least, but somehow I had this sense of audacity or freedom that no one's looking. And what it, for some reason, I don't know, well, I do know actually what it was got me thinking about this. I started looking at paintings and writing poems about them. And I ended up, each time I'd written a poem, I thought, well, now I've got to look at something different and try and produce something which is different from the poem I've just written, a different voice, a different angle, a different perspective on the art. So that kept me going for about 3 months, and I wrote 30 poems. So I was on a I was on a sort of a 3-day cycle. I would give myself a day to look at works of art on the internet, read up things. I'd read Wikipedia pages. They would link to other places, essays by art historians, you know, all kinds of things, whatever I could find on the internet. And then that would set me searching for, in order to write the poem, questions about the period, the clothing of the period, the techniques of the artists, a lot of things completely unrelated to art, just brought up by the picture. So I produced these paintings and then these poems on paintings. And then it occurred to me later to put them into a slideshow.
Brilliant, yes.
Like an art lecture. What it is, it's a kind of a live reading of the poems with lots of images. And my first idea was one poem about one painting, but with some of them, like, for example, I have a poem about Van Gogh, and I've illustrated it with about a dozen or 15 paintings.
Yeah, brilliant. That sounds really fun. So are you enjoying being a performer? Kind of going out and performing your poems on stage.
Yeah, so I've been doing it mainly on Zoom. And of course, during lockdown, I put it together for a group of people I knew in Santa Barbara in California, where we lived for a while. So I put it together as a Zoom performance. And then I've done it now about 3 times live. And I'm doing it in about 10 days' time as part of the Wandsworth Arts Fringe in Balham Baptist Church.
If anybody, you've got a poster there, haven't you, about I don't know if anybody here, I don't know if anybody's local, but here. Is that a great picture? I love that.
So there, it's called Out of the Frame. And I'm doing it this time in London with an actor friend called Zimmy Ryan. So I'm presenting ourselves as Joe and Zimmy, Out of the Frame. I feel that these poems have found their natural form of publishing in this, because the artwork is fabulous, and there are lots of images, and I don't think it would lend itself particularly to a book, which in any case would involve all kinds of copyright issues, permissions, and all that.
For a book, having worked so much in art history publishing as an editor before writing it myself, art history publishing, if you don't have permission, is a nightmare. Yeah. You never want to go near either Salvador Dali or Pablo Picasso, I can tell you that. Emma, I have just put the... Emma's asked for the Zoom link for Out of the Frame. What I've done is I've put in the chat the link to the Wandsworth Fringe. Is there another link that you can give, Joe? Do you still do Zoom performances or not? Is it on your website?
I do Zoom performances by request with groups of people. It's wandsworthartsfringe.com. And if you put in Out of the Frame, once you get to the thing, you can search.
Put that link in there for Out of the Frame. They can see that there. What I will do for everybody who's asking, I'm also putting Joe's website in there, so you can always contact him if you want to know more about it. But if you are able to get to Wandsworth Fringe is up there. That link is on there as well. So, yeah. Joe, what I'm going to do now is I'm very quickly going to tell people what's coming up. Do not go away. I have some more questions for you. But I'm just going to tell everybody what is coming up on Goldster in the next few days. So on Tuesday next week, you've got Purpose, Passion, Grit, PPG, and Humphrey is going to be talking to Heidi Mansfield. She's worked for many years with children with special needs. And she's going to be talking about her really kind of amazing event, her amazing work, and founding the charity Activity Station, which offers fun and exciting outings and activities for people with disabilities. So she's going to be talking next Tuesday, the 14th of June. And then to tell you what else is coming up on the book club. So next week, we've got on, well, actually, first of all, your book of the month this month to read with Humphrey is George Orwell with Animal Farm. That is the end of the month, but do get reading soon. And then I'm back again on Thursday, and I'm going to be talking to Leslie Thompson. She is the writer of the Detective's Daughter series of crime novels. And she's also got a new book called The Companion, which is so new. I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I haven't actually got my copy yet because it's not coming out till I think it's this week. And then Humphrey is back on Friday with Victoria Schofield. She's one of the our leading authors on military history in South Asia. She's written widely on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Her first book was Bhutto Trial and Execution, published in 1978 about the death sentence and hanging of the former Prime Minister of Pakistan. And she's written lots of books since then. So join Humphrey for that one next Friday. And then the following Thursday, I am back with Victoria Panton-Bacon, who was actually, she talked a little bit, for those of you who came along to the Jubilee event, she was there as well. She was there as a Goldster member, and she was talking a little bit. But she has written a book called Remarkable Women of the Second World War. And this is based on women whose voices have never really been heard before, but she's unearthed them through her research. It's really intriguing. And then Humphrey is back on the Friday with Maggie Piggott, who is really, really fascinating. She's lovely, actually. I know her through the Society of Authors. You're going to love this, Goldster people, because it's called How to Age Joyfully, 8 Steps to a Happier, Fuller Life. So thank you for hanging around there, Joe. Sorry, it's quite long and convoluted that. So we have a comment and a question here. The comment says, you give me hope. So far, I have submitted 4 manuscripts and all were rejected, making me feel useless. Well, we've all been there, every single writer. Do you want to add anything to that, Joe?
Yeah. I think it's a very haphazard business. There's a lot to do with luck, just finding the right person, the agent or the editor who likes something and is willing to take it on. I think agents and editors are spoilt for choice. Lots of people sending them stuff, and they can afford to wait until they get something that personally excites them. And I think a lot of them are motivated by a personal connection with something they read. So it's worth to keep trying.
I would say don't give up. Don't give up. Absolutely. Everybody has rejected manuscripts. And I may have told you all this before, but I remember being at a literary festival and New Zealand's premier crime writer was there, a guy called Paul Cleave. He is there, Ian Rankin. He's huge in America as well. And he was very honest about how many drafts his work has had to go through. And he said his most recent book, the one he was promoting there, was on its 16th draft before it finally was accepted by the editor. And I was really impressed that he said that. And I think that it's true. You have to work with an editor. You have to take on board comments, but also they're not always right. Not every editor is going to be right for your particular book. So I really think you shouldn't give up. Another, we've got a question here. Before one publishes their memoir about families, is it okay to give copies to the people you mentioned? Or should you just ignore it and get it published regardless of what they're going to say? What do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, you're not planning necessarily on publishing yours, but what do you see about, think about that?
I would be inclined to let people see it if you're concerned. The question, the question would be worth having in your mind is, if they don't like it, what am I going to do about that?
I agree.
But if you're ready to say, well, as a courtesy, I'm showing you this, they may make a comment that makes you inclined to change something. But you've also got to be ready, I suppose, to say, well, they don't like it, but they'll have to live with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, you know, you just have to decide, as long as you're not saying something libelous, by the way. Yeah. You have to be very careful about that if you're publishing it. And if you are publishing it with a reputable publisher, hopefully their legal team would talk you through anything like that. And I just want to say thank you, everyone, for coming along. And Carol sent me a lovely message about last week. I'm very glad that you enjoyed that special Jubilee one. It was the first time, Joe, that I did one of my books. I just gave a talk without having an author guest about my book, Elizabeth Revealed, because it was the Jubilee. And I'm really glad, Carol, that you enjoyed it. And it was a slightly different stance on Goldster to have everybody being able to chat. So we might do a few more like that, because we did love being able to have the Goldster community feel back as well. But we're just going to keep coming up with new ideas for Book Club. And as you know, we love your ideas and tips for which authors you would like us to talk to. So thank you so much, Joe, for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure to have you on. Good luck with Out of the Frame. I think that's a really great project, and I hope that you enjoy it. We've got a comment here. Your book of air is one of the best well-written books. Well done. So here we are.
Thank you very much.
So I hope that Wandsworth Fringe is good. I hope it feels good being back in public, you know, not being locked down anymore. But I do hope you keep doing your Zooms as well, because I think that it's such a great way to connect with people all over the world. So good luck with it.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. Take care, everybody. Have a lovely weekend. Joe and I are going to turn off our videos now, and then Joe Concierge, will end the meeting. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews, to expand your world, and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.